All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show from yesterday. God dang it. I do that sometimes. You're not supposed to say welcome back until, you know, you've been on for at least one segment, Horton. Memorize that, dude. All right. Memorized. Well, I'm Scott. This is my show. Welcome back to it from yesterday. All right. My website is scotthorton.org. Go and click on them ads, would you? Let's spend money at them places. I made some new ads for you. I don't have them in place yet. I got more to go, too. I wrote some last night. I was only able to record, what, three or four today. I got two more to go, at least. Two or three more. I'm sorry. I know my ads are stale now. What I'm going to try to do, I got so many, at least with the FFF and the CNI and a couple of the others, that I'm going to try to run different ones on different days kind of thing and mix it up as much as I can. I don't know. What the hell? It's my show. I can do whatever I want. Here, I'm going to see if I can put a couple of these in place for you here. I do have to move them from one computer to the other and stall for time. By saying things like, Jacob Hornberger is going to be on the show today. Isn't that great? Yeah, man. Good old Jacob Hornberger. See, he's got this thing in FFF, at FFF today, where it's his review of The War State by Michael Swanson, which went out in the Future of Freedom. But but is now, god dang, I'm sorry, I can't do two things at once, not this high. He wrote this review of Michael Swanson's book, but it only ran, you know, in the monthly journal, and then it's under a delay, call it a future freedom buffer there, before it runs on the website. So now it's on the website, and so it's brand new again. And so, since the Future Freedom Foundation helps sponsor the show, and since the War State helps sponsor the show, and the Future Freedom Foundation wrote an article about the War State, it seems like I ought to interview him about it. And also, well, you know, I love this stuff. That's what the show's about. I mean, I hate it, but you know what I mean. I love hating it. A lot. Alright, so you want to hear my new War State spot? I'm going to play my new War State spot for you.
The military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced...
Hey, I'm Scott Horton. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job of telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Ike, JFK, and LBJ all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how we've gotten to where we are today, bankrupt, corrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and Audible.com. Just click the logo in the right margin at scotthorton.org or check out Mike's own site, thewarstate.com. All right, that's all. There you go. That is right there for you, the fruits of my labor from this morning. Oh, also I took some notes about some news I'm going to cover for you, too. And you know what I got? I still got to write a new bumpersticker.com, thebumpersticker.com one. And I think I have a new libertystickers.com one, but I didn't make it yet. What was it? What do I got left to do here? Yeah, I got a new Liberty Stickers and a new offnow.org, too. Although they're not really sponsoring the show anymore, but that's all right, because I really want to push this thing anyway, and maybe they'll start sponsoring the show again. But, yeah. My new, here's take one of my new Liberty Sticker spot, all right? Listen, you hate government? One of them libertarian types? Maybe you just can't stand the president, the gun controllers, or the warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them. But still, if you're driving around and you want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. Liberty Stickers has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. And they'll handle all your custom printing at thebumpersticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I think I nailed that one first try, huh? God dang, I never got one of these on the first try before. There must have been a mistake in there somewhere. All right, well, what do you think, chat room guys? Ta-da, huh? Huh? Can I use that? Can I just save that? Take one, my new Liberty sticker spot? All right. And then, yeah, I got to do a bumper sticker. Well, I'll save you. I'll spare your lives. I'll spare your ears. The off now clip, because we're about to go out to commercial again anyway. It's the Scott Horton Show. When we get back, I got Ukraine, I got Syria, Iraq. Oh, man. I don't even want to cover Iraq news today. I got Iraq. I got, oh, man, this new thing by good old Clive Stafford Smith in The Guardian about Shaker Amer. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and spoil this one for you right now. I can't help myself. This piece, it'll be running at antiwar.com tomorrow. It's at The Guardian today. It's Clive Stafford Smith, the lawyer from Reprieve, and he represents this guy, Shaker Amer, and I'm sorry because I'm sure I'm saying his name wrong, but anyway, he's an innocent man, held at Guantanamo since 2002, without charges, and has been cleared for release for 7 years, and they're still holding him. And anyway, one of the things he tells his lawyer, which I believe... I say you put the entire Bush cabinet on the gallows until they can prove themselves innocent beyond a shadow of a doubt and see how they like that standard of proof. He claims that as they were torturing him, that the worst torture he endured was the second, what do they call it? The second hand torture, the second degree, threatening his family while we have you kidnapped here, shackled to the wall, helpless. Oh, yeah, we got your wife and we got your kids. And, I mean, I don't want to go into the details. You can go read at The Guardian right now if you want. But, anyway, what they were threatening to do to his 5-year-old daughter, what they were promising him they were doing to his 5-year-old daughter. Go and wave your American flag and put your hand over your heart and shed a tear for the freedom fought for while you read that one. Take all your nationalist warmonger slogans and, I don't know, chant them really loud while you read Clive Stafford Smith today, The Guardian. How they tortured his client, Shaker Amer. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Yeah, boy, Ukraine. Well, you know, I don't know. I was trying to get some guests on. It wasn't working. Talk about Ukraine. I mean, I know Hornberger has principled things to say about it, but really could use, I don't know. Maybe I will try to call Ray McGovern. I should, right, during the break. See if I can get Ray on. Daniel Larrison's going to be on the show tomorrow. But Ray, you know what, even when he's traveling, he's happy to do the show. He's such a nice guy. And, I really should bring you guys somebody really knows their stuff. And he does. To talk about what's going on here. You know, Eli Lake, who I admit he does some groundbreaking reporting sometimes. More importantly, he helped lie you into war with Iraq and helped push every ridiculous neocon talking point about how great torture is, about how they found Saddam's weapons over and over again, ties between Saddam and Osama and everything else. He's just one of the worst. One of, right up there with Jeffrey Goldberg and Judith Miller and Michael Gordon and the very worst reporters who lied you into war with Iraq. He really is horrible. And you can tell he's, you know, and he makes no secret if you follow him on Twitter or whatever, you can tell his social relationships are all with the neoconservatives. These are the people he identifies with and pals around with. And anyway, so he's got this piece today, and it's a supposed scandal that Russia is prepared to invade eastern Ukraine, he says, and the Americans aren't sharing all their intelligence with Ukrainian military that they need to know. And Lake is here quoting U.S. government officials saying, you know, it's a bad policy. They ought to be filled in and this kind of thing, I think. Isn't that what I read in that piece of crap? Anyway, I just kind of skimmed it. My real point is the assumption that Russia is fixing to invade eastern Ukraine. Now, I can't, you know, recommend that anyone assume that it's impossible or could not happen. I kind of thought that he was just going to, you know, basically withdraw from Crimea after it was settled, that he was going to keep his base or whatever. I don't know. I kind of underestimated his how far he was going then. It's kind of funny, right? Just invade, having guys invade with no badges. It just brought up the question of, I mean, everybody knew they were Russian troops, but, you know, oh, so maybe they want to be deniable so they could take it back? That was my speculation, but no, they just wanted to make it, just barely raise the question so that it wasn't completely clear what was happening when it was happening. That's all. Worked well. And they took the Crimean Peninsula, which has been part of Russia since forever and everything like that. But so now they want us to believe that the Russians are going to invade Ukraine, eastern Ukraine at least, maybe all of the eastern half, maybe the whole damn country, I don't know. And they claim, although who could believe them, after all we've been through, that their satellite pictures and whatever other intelligence say that the Russians are really preparing. They're not just, you know, moving around some. They're really preparing with their mobile medical units and all of these things for, you know, real conflict to come in the short term. And so anyway, I wonder what Ray thinks about that. I guess my position is that, well, like I said yesterday, right? It's not that big of a hurdle to take it back and go ahead and invade after they promise not to. And maybe, you know, it's just smokescreen by swearing that they don't mean to. And they don't care about paying that political price at all. They just want to put us off for just a minute. That's possible, I guess. But it seems like they would have a lot to lose, you know, diplomatically, in terms of their relations with the rest of the nation states of the UN and whatever that they have to deal with. However, let it not go unsaid that the people in eastern Ukraine, at least some of them, are declaring they want to secede from Ukraine. They want to declare independence and they want to be annexed by Russia. And they're calling for Russian peacekeepers to come in. And they've sacked the government buildings and whatever. If you heard the top of the hour news, they quoted John Kerry talking about, you know, what a complete sham this is. You know, this isn't the people of eastern Ukraine sacking these government buildings because that's what they want. This is, well, let's get his exact words here. Daniel McAdams has Kerry's number over at RonPaulInstitute.org. Where Kerry says this is an illegal and illegitimate effort to destabilize a sovereign state. And says that the whole thing is funded by the Russian special services. Well, poor Dan McAdams. I think he would prefer to have to try harder to write an article and not just have the damn thing write itself for him all the time. What kind of challenge is that? This is absolutely ridiculous. It's America and their European sock puppet satellite states that picked this fight. We got the lady on tape. How in the world can they just go on pretending that, oh no, you don't have the lady on tape. Yeah, we got the lady on tape. We got her on tape.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know.
This is the American Undersecretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, plotting on the phone with Jeffrey Pyatt, the ambassador to Ukraine, on their picks to run the new government.
That's right. Okay.
After the coup.
Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, see, the Germans are moving too slow. We need to have, we're going to go around them and have the UN send their guy, and he's going to make this deal.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
No, exactly, and I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me VFR saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great. All right. Thanks.
Yeah, there you go. We'll get the vice president to do it. And there they are, perfectly aware that they're sticking it to the Russians. Of course, that's their real point in the first place. They insisted that the EU trade deal that the Ukrainians were prepared to sign be all or nothing. And you may not have a like trade deal with the Russians at the same time if you're going to have this deal with us. It was a deal he couldn't possibly accept. And then the riots and the neo-Nazis in the street and now in the parliament. And heading the security services. And so this is what, of course, and then not only that, but the new post-coup government immediately after the neo-Nazis seized all the buildings, all the government buildings in Kiev, and ran the president out of town. They passed a language law making Russian no longer an official language of the state of Ukraine, which was picking a giant fight with the entire population of the East and especially Crimea. And it was, by definition, an illegal and illegitimate effort to destabilize a sovereign state. For the Americans to come out now pretending that Russian intervention, and I mean, I have no reason to believe, but also no reason to doubt that the Russians are helping with this instability in the East. Why wouldn't they be playing their side of the game? But still, to try to put it all on them, really? Everything wrong in Ukraine right now is because of big bad Putin. Does anybody believe that? I mean, the people who would have you believe that, do you think that they really believe that? Any of them? Oh, no, you must not remember February because, you know, that's ancient history, dude. Don't pay attention to when America did this coup in the first place and picked this entire fight. Anyway, this could end up leading to war. I don't guess that it looks like it's going to right now, but this is how wars can start sometimes. And there are many hawks in America and, I don't know, anywhere else who keeps saying that it doesn't matter if Ukraine is in NATO or not. And we need to protect them right now. We need to lay down the gauntlet. We need to start landing troops. We need to let the Russians know that this will not stand, and this kind of crap, this kind of nonsense. And so, you know, I think it was Doug Bandow who wrote the other day about how, listen, you know, when they expanded NATO, I'm putting words in his mouth, but his basic point was that this was just a giant project for, you know, expanding the bureaucracies and paying off the arms industries. And it was never really a war guarantee because they never thought they'd need it. You know, oh, please, some terrorists hiding out in Afghanistan attack us. We can mobilize NATO against that. So, but did anybody really contemplate having a nuclear war over Latvia or Estonia or Lithuania or Ukraine? That's the thing about drawing lines. It was at least credible when they drew a line halfway across Germany and said, thou shalt not pass. But now we're talking about 1,000 miles east of there, on Russia's door. And the American people, the polls say, are good on this. They don't want this. This is just the empire's interest, not ours, not at all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And our guest today is Jacob Hornberger. He's the founder and the president of the Future Freedom Foundation. Welcome back to the show, Jacob. How you doing?
Fine. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be back.
Well, good times. Happy to have you here. Hey, so you and Sheldon Richman are on a speaking tour around the Northeast, correct?
That's correct.
All right, so tell us, where all are you going, and the dates and times and all these things?
Well, yeah, we're doing it in conjunction with the Young Americans for Liberty, and their local chapters at the schools we're visiting are putting together the event, the venue, promoting it, and so forth. And we've already done Monday and Tuesday, and tonight we're going to Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York. So if anybody's in that area, come out and see us tonight. It's at the lecture hall on campus, and that'll be at 7 o'clock. And then tomorrow night we're going to be at the University of Albany. And then the following night, Friday night, which is the last leg of our tour, is at the University of Vermont in Burlington, Vermont.
Great.
But yeah, we're having a blast. I mean, we're just, you know, we're taking our libertarian angle internet show that we do every Monday. We're taking it live, and so we have a spontaneous conversation between Sheldon and myself for 30 minutes, and then we involve the audience in the conversation where they have input, questions, answers, comments. So it's really a nice little analysis of libertarian issues and applying them to the burning issues of the day. We're showing these kids that the only real practical thing is to advocate pure, uncompromising libertarian solutions, and that they ought to go beyond these reform things that we always hear from conservatives and start talking about restoring a genuine free society to our land by dismantling all this status junk.
Cool. Well, so, hey, I know you've been doing this a long time. FFF, you founded back in 89, right?
That's right. This is about 25 years now.
So tell me about the difference in going and talking to young people like this. Is it... Are the numbers that much more? Are they that much more educated? Or has anything changed, really?
Oh, it's an incredible, it's a sea change. I mean, you know, when we started in the movement, I started in the movement 25 years ago, I mean, it was a relatively small movement. And, I mean, you could barely find any college kids that were interested in this. You know, I was several years later in the 80s, I was program director at the Foundation for Economic Education. And even then, I mean, there were some kids that would come to our seminars, but mostly it was because their parents sent them there or their grandparents or something. But what we're seeing now is kids that are really, really have this fire in the belly for libertarianism, and they believe in it passionately. And they're self-educated because they're not getting educated on like Austrian economics and libertarianism in college, obviously. And so we're showing up at these events, and they've read Mises and Hayek, and they know Bastiat and Hazlitt. And it's incredible. I mean, we already have common ground to have conversations with, but it's clear that what they're doing is studying in the summertime or studying on weekends on things that they're passionate about that obviously they're not getting any credit in school for. And so I can't tell you how impressive it is. I mean, that's why we're on this tour, is to kind of, ignite fires within these kids and kind of transmit our passion for this philosophy to them, but also to raise their vision to a higher level, because, you know, there's so many people that just advocate reform, like Obamacare. We got to get rid of Obamacare, but they don't go to the root of the problem. And that is Medicare, Medicaid, government intervention, licensure, and so forth. So what our aim in this tour is to raise their vision to a higher level and say, look, we got to talk in terms of dismantling Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and not phase them out, but just repealing them. And of course, the national security state, the giant military empire, CIA, NSA, we hit it all, Scott, within a half hour in a conversation between Sheldon and me, we pretty much hit the basics and the application of the basics. And by the time the hour is over, there are a few libertarian subjects that we haven't covered, believe it or not.
Man, that's great. And you post at least some of these online at the videos on YouTube and at FFF.org too, right?
Well, our weekly meetings where Sheldon and I get together and talk about libertarian principles and apply them to what's going on in the world today, those are all online. People can, right. They're on YouTube, and you can just go access those. These that we're doing here with these groups, we're not videotaping. Can't get those. You have to come to the event and get them live if you want to get participate.
I see. Well, maybe you could do that thing like you do with your journal articles and hold them for a couple of months, and that way you still encourage people to come on out, but then also later on, we can watch them, those of us who couldn't possibly make it to Vermont for your show on Friday.
Yeah, well, what we found is, it's so expensive to videotape events. And then we figured there's more spontaneity when people know they're not being recorded. There's just more of a casualness.
Yeah,
freer
I can
about
see
what
that,
they
too.
Say. So we figured it's an academic environment. We just thought we'd make it more of a discussion, and people don't have to worry about, I'm going to be on tape, or what if I make a fool of myself with my question, all that sort of thing goes on at a program.
Well, let me ask you this. Well, first, let me say this, then I'll ask you something. When I gave that speech at your event, at the Students for Liberty event there in February, John Glazer's part of the talk was the libertarian part, and mine was the more empire part. But, he really emphasized in his speech, and I think he had told me, and we had talked about, how important he thought it was to really focus on this in this way, because he feels like in Washington, D.C., these kids are a lot more kind of young Republican-y, and they're not very radical. They might be radical on Medicare and Medicaid and stuff like that that they couldn't possibly need, that kind of thing, but they're not nearly as versed in or concerned with matters of the national security state and civil liberties and that kind of stuff, which, of course, is ranks as first priority to me, although bankruptcy and all that could be pretty bad for peace and liberty all the way around too, don't get me wrong about the other stuff, but I wonder if that's your experience, that maybe a lot of these kids, they come from the right, they're kind of fiscal conservative, but they really need whooping into shape to really make libertarians out of them.
I don't think there's any doubt about it. I mean, because they're like all the rest of us. You know, we discovered libertarianism, I think, mostly through economics, maybe through the drug war. But very few are exposed to the libertarian case on foreign policy, empire, civil liberties. And that we consider that, or I do, I consider this a much graver threat to our freedom and our well-being than the welfare state. And that was a big eye-opener to me when I finally realized what the Founding Fathers were concerned about, you know, why they opposed standing armies, and that danger exists to this day. I mean, President Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex as a threat to our democratic processes, and that threat has not diminished. In fact, it's grown. And these kids would not be exposed to this type of thinking because we all grow up with this idea that the national security state is part of a free society, that, in fact, our freedom is owed to the CIA and the NSA and the giant military, that they're out there protecting our freedoms, you know, a force for freedom, you know. And it's the exact opposite. And that's what our objective is, to come in and say, look, you know, there's reasons why the Founding Fathers of this country opposed this kind of way of life. And even if you buy it as part of the Cold War syndrome, which was the justification for this radical change in direction, as Eisenhower pointed out in his farewell speech, the Cold War ended. And so what are we still doing with NATO and military bases all over the world and regime change operations and sanctions and all this stuff? Well, you know, most of the crises that they use to justify this are caused by them or provoked by them. And so that's what our objective is here, is to raise the vision of these kids. And even if they don't agree with us, you know, it's not really important that they agree with us, but we're over there saying, here is something to consider. And if they never hear the idea, Scott, then they're never going to consider it. And our objective is, hey, let's plant the idea there, and then they can decide for themselves whether it's a good one or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a lot of times, a lot of insight can be gained just by confusing somebody and then letting them work it out for themselves. I remember Anthony Gregory, who writes for FFF.org, by the way, and for the Future Freedom. He told me one time about a speech that he gave where a kid came up to him after and said, but wait, so I'm still confused. You're against taxes and prisons? And Anthony said, well, yeah, of course. No taxes, no prisons. No prisons, no taxes. And the kid just, his mind's just blown because here, you know, Anthony is more right-wing than the right-wing on everything they're good on, and he's more left-wing than the left-wing on everything they're good on. And it's, you know, puritanical libertarianism walking, right? Pure libertarianism, Richmondian libertarianism, and... So I think, you know, where you can surprise people that, wow, so Jacob, it sounds like you hate Medicaid, but then you're telling me you hate Empire more than you hate Medicaid? And people just, they don't know what to do with that until, you know, hopefully once you explain yourself, they kind of realize that, oh, I'm living in a world where people actually think some things I'd never quite considered before, but sound like they make a lot more sense maybe than what I have been hearing all this time.
Right, and especially at the college level, you know, where kids are figuring out, you know, what their philosophy is, what their guiding light is, what they were born to do. They're trying to figure out what they want to do with the rest of their lives. And that is the academic experience, to be exposed to all kinds of different ideas and go back to your dorm and debate them and argue them and whatever, even if you haven't made up your mind. And so that's why we love to come to these campuses, because there's an intellectual honesty there that the kids are generally interested in principles. You know, principles matter and ideas matter and ideals matter to them. And life hasn't battered them into conformity yet. And so we sit here and say, okay, here's the libertarian paradigm. And again, you know, we don't expect a total agreement, 100% agreement, although we get it with some of the libertarians that have studied this stuff. But to me, it's like tonight. The organizer told me, hey, I've invited a bunch of people that don't necessarily agree with libertarianism. They don't really understand it. They're curious. And I said, fantastic.
Great, yeah.
I mean, that makes for an exciting, you know, presentation and discussion when you got people that don't necessarily agree with you. Right. It's fun.
All right, and again, that one is tonight at Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York, at the lecture hall there. We got to go out to this break. When we get back, we're going to talk with Jacob a little bit more about his tour with Sheldon Richman around the Northeast this week. And we're also going to talk about Michael Swanson's book, The War State. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I got Jacob Hornberger. He's the founder and the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org and fff.org/subscribe for their monthly journal, The Future of Freedom. And again, he and Sheldon Richman, editor of the Future of Freedom, are going to be doing a talk tonight at Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York, at the lecture hall there. And tomorrow they'll be at the University of Albany. And on Friday they'll be at the University of Vermont. So look into that. Check out your Young Americans for Liberty chapters, etc. If you can get nearby any of those places, or if you're a student at any of those universities, go and meet Jacob Hornberger and Sheldon Richman in person and ask them really hard questions like, what's so great about the book The War State by Michael Swanson anyway, Jacob?
Oh, it's one of the most awesome books I've ever read in this area. I mean, that somebody that wants to understand the origins of the warfare state that under which we've all been born and raised, this is the book. I mean, I'll never forget when I got the book in the mail, I didn't even know who Mike Swanson was. And I often get books from authors, you know, as part of our work at the Future of Freedom Foundation. And I'll thumb through them, but most of them are kind of like not our cup of tea. They've got a call for reform or vouchers or something. And, you know, if something isn't pure and uncompromising, we won't review it. We won't promote it or anything. So I thought, well, this is just one of those standard books. And so I'd never heard of it. So I started thumbing through it, looked at the table of contents, and I said, oh, my gosh. And I started looking more carefully, and I said, wow. So I took it home and read it, and I couldn't put it down. It was just this absolutely fantastic presentation of how we got the warfare state, primarily since World War II, and it opened up with Eisenhower's farewell address that I mentioned earlier. But it gives the whole roots of it, the consequences of it, how it turned our country into effectively a garrison state. We ended up adopting totalitarian methods that even live to this day, torture, assassination, and Swanson puts it all together. And so we ultimately met, and we got to be friends, and it's just been a real joy to get to know this guy. He's actually an investment advisor, but he's a historian. He went to the University of Virginia. He either got his master's or he's studying for his PhD or both or something. And so he really knows his history, and he knows how to research. And he's done just this fantastic job with this book. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. In fact, it was the lead article in our monthly journal, Future of Freedom.
Right, and that article is now on the website. It was published today on the regular part of the articles section at fff.org. It's The Origins of America's Warfare State by Jacob Hornberger, the review of The War State by Michael Swanson here. And I guess, can you tell us, were there any surprises in there or anything unique that you learned, say, about the Eisenhower era that you didn't really understand before that he helped clarify, or something that you think really stands out that people ought to be aware of that, you know, to kind of, because, you know, I got to tell you, man, I was born in 76, and I grew up in the Ronald Reagan kind of brinksmanship, renewed Cold War kind of after detente and all that era, and it's just always been the case my entire existence that America garrisons the planet, that the president reigns supreme. He is our leader and all of this stuff. And you're telling me that this is all artificial from, you know, post-World War II. But the problem is World War II was so long before I was born. 30 years before I was born, it was over. So, you know, maybe that's just the way it is now. I don't know. You know, you're always trying to say that this is alien. It should be considered alien to our system. But maybe it's not. I don't know. Maybe did I set you up for a good answer there somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I nothing sticks out in Swanson's book as something really special that sticks out. What I saw is that here is a guy that recognizes that this is not the standard American way of life in which our country was founded. That there really is a remarkable shift. I guess something that does stand out where he says between World War I and World War II. Despite the fact that Americans had adopted an income tax in 1913, you know, here they had gone most of the first century of America's existence without any income taxation. You made it, you kept it, you decided what to do with it because there was no welfare programs either, like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Well, so the income tax adopted in 1913. I was stunned when he says that between the two wars, World War I and World War II, a very small minority of people were paying income taxes. I think it was like 2.5% or 3% or something like that, that it was imposed just on the rich, which, of course, we libertarians would oppose. We oppose, you know, all taxation, but especially income taxation. But then after World War II, when the military says, oh, look, we know we had to build up this huge military force to fight the Nazis, but, oh, by the way, now you have to keep it as a permanent part of American life to fight our new enemy, the Soviet Union, which had been our partner in World War II. And so you've got this big Cold War thing that the communists are coming to get us. And then the income tax starts getting imposed on everybody to the point of where it is today, where even the poorest people are suffering under the burden of this huge tax on the IRS. And I think that was a stunner. But what's really remarkable about this book is he just puts it all together in a really readable format. I mean, this isn't your academic tome that's difficult to get through. It's just for the regular person, what I call the educated layman, who is interested in knowing how we got to where we are today with this huge military empire and the CIA and the NSA. But he doesn't delve much into the NSA or the CIA. It's really the military empire that he deals with, which is one of the three components of the national security state. But it's a fantastic summary of how we got to where we are today.
It's really interesting to me to read about Eisenhower's quarrels with the military and how even when he did win, he just barely won. And you can kind of, when you listen to his farewell speech after reading The War State, you can kind of feel the tone of voice a little bit better there, where he's really coming from, where he's tired after 8 years of battling these guys. And, of course, Eisenhower's version of battling them was to try to limit the size of the army and just make more hydrogen bombs and do more CIA coup d'etats. That was the limited empire under Ike before the real brinksmanship started, you know what I mean? And the real arms buildups of the Democrats that came after him. But, you know, it just portrays even Eisenhower as you know, maybe the cowboy grappling to the hydrogen bomb from Dr. Strangelove, but no more than that. The beast is way bigger even than the supreme allied commander of World War II at that point, by the time he's the president of the United States.
Yeah, and I think we need to keep in mind that he wasn't just a passive actor in this, that he's the guy that approves the Mossadegh plan, where the CIA is going in there to oust the democratically appointed prime minister of an independent country. And he's the one that puts his stamp of approval on it. And then 1 year later, he puts his stamp of approval on doing the exact same thing in Guatemala. And so, you know, it's not like he was just saying, well, I oppose this and I'm fighting with the military and the CIA over this. This guy was going along with it. Now, granted, it may have been the CIA that was coming up with the ideas. Certainly they had come up with the Iranian coup before Eisenhower got to power. Truman had nixed it, and then the CIA comes back and presents it as an anti-communist plan to Eisenhower, and he goes along with it. So, and he's there for the big buildup of this huge military empire. So he buys into the whole Cold War, you know, the communists are coming to get us and so forth, and he buys into the Truman Doctrine where we have to keep the communists out of every country in the world. And so then after 8 years of this, he says, oh, by the way, I want to warn you guys of how dangerous this is to our democratic processes. Well, why didn't he do that at the beginning? Why didn't he just say, like, this is all a crock? We're not going to sacrifice our freedoms. We're not going to sacrifice our principles. We're going to fight communism with a free society rather than by adopting the policies that are adherent to totalitarian regimes.
Right, especially because he was Ike. So in that whole only Nixon can go to China sense, he should have been able to tell the American people, hey, listen, we got a real problem here, and I need you guys to back me on this. And the American people would have absolutely backed him. If anyone in American society had the ability to face down the empire that he'd inherited from Harry Truman, it would have been Ike Eisenhower, and he just didn't do it.
Absolutely. He had the total credibility as, you know, head of Allied forces, Army general, revered by the American people. He would have been the guy to say, we're not going down this militarist road. We are going to fight this totalitarianism by a free society, and we're going to show the world that this is the way you do it, instead of embargoes on Cuba and invasions at the Bay of Pigs and so forth. And the other interesting thing about this is that, you know, he gave a fairly free hand to the CIA. You know, he didn't try to rein them in. He didn't try to control me. He just put Alan Dulles in charge, and, you know, he sort of let them do their own thing. So by the time Kennedy comes into power, you know, that was one of the things they hated Kennedy for, is that Kennedy was putting tight controls on the CIA all of a sudden. He was reining them in. In fact, he even threatened to tear the CIA into 1,000 pieces. He didn't like the CIA, and they didn't like that at all. You know, they really expected Nixon to be elected, and Nixon was Eisenhower's vice president, so they saw this sort of continuity. And all of a sudden, Kennedy gets elected, and their attitude is, who are you to come and control us? We've lived 8 years of running the show ourselves.
Yeah, well, he shouldn't have kept them at all. Maybe that was his problem. He should have fired every last one of them upon taking office. Anyway.
Yeah, well, he fires Dulles. He fires, Dulles' right-hand man, and then another guy that he transfers out of there. So, I mean, to fire, practically the founder of the CIA, I mean, Dulles was this revered figure. That was huge. But what he really should have done was present to the American people why the CIA needed to be abolished at this point. And, I mean, he did threaten to tear them into 1,000 pieces, which to me is saying, I'm gonna take away all your power. And they knew that that's what he was aiming at, and yet, you know, he leaves it in existence, and we've got this monstrosity still today.
Well, you know, I've always been a real skeptic about the they killed him because he was an angel theory, but I think that Swanson certainly has done the most out of anyone to convince me that after the Cuban Missile Crisis, he really did decide that he had to do something to limit what these guys were doing. And I don't know if he was really going to get out of Vietnam or if it was the test ban treaty he was pushing or whatever it was that pushed them over the edge. And again, you know, I'm not exactly certain who hired the hitmen, who fired the shot or whatever, but I'd concede that Swanson has convinced me that even if JFK started out as a Clinton or an Obama, that maybe he started going a little Kucinich there toward the end. I don't know. I'm still a little skeptical.
Oh, it's a dramatic shift. It's an absolutely dramatic shift, and the mainstream historians are now recognizing it. You know, they denied it for so many years, but after Kennedy knew, and so did Khrushchev, that the Cuban Missile Crisis brought us to the very edge of extinction with all-out nuclear war. And in fact, if Kennedy had followed what the military wanted him to do during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we wouldn't be standing today. They were telling him, go in there and bomb. and invade. And what they didn't know was the commanders on the ground had battlefield authority to use nuclear weapons, which they had. And so an invasion or a bombing would have resulted in nuclear missiles being fired immediately. And so after that, Kennedy recognizes, he's got this soul search, and he says, my gosh, I came so close. So he has this secret correspondence going on with Khrushchev, and Khrushchev's going through the same soul searching, and they're saying, let's end this. Let's end the Cold War. Let's live like today we live with Vietnam, and we live with China, Cuba. I mean, there's communist countries, but there's no antagonism. There's no hatred and anger like there was during the Cold War. That's what Kennedy was aiming for with Khrushchev, and that's what scared the death out of the military-industrial complex and the national security state, because their position was, you can't trust the communists. You can't reach a deal where you're going to disarm, because the communists are just lulling you into existence, and they were looking at this thing, we're going to go to war, at some point we're going to go to war, and Kennedy was effectively disarming America and surrendering.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm sorry we got to leave it there, but I've already kept you more than half an hour, and I got to go because Clive Stafford Smith is next about America's torture regime here. So thank you very much for your time, Jacob.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Scott. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, so that's Jacob Hornberg, everybody. He's a founder and the president of the Future Freedom Foundation. Me and all my guests, everybody's been flubbing the endings lately. It's my fault, I think. Go and see him and Sheldon Richmond speak. Go to fff.org for more details. They're in Binghamton, New York tonight. All right, be right back after this crappy news break. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And my website is scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003, scotthorton.org. Also, you can join up the chat room during the show if you want, scotthorton.org/chat. And our next guest on the show today is Clive Stafford Smith. He is the head of Reprieve, and they are lawyers who represent the otherwise helpless. Welcome to the show, Clive. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, Scott.
Well, good. Thank you for joining us on the show today. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciated this piece in The Guardian today, as horrible as it was. It's entitled, When Will We Put a Stop to Shaker Amer's Horrific Guantanamo Ordeal, we in this case being the people of Great Britain, I suppose.
And the people of America. I'm afraid I'm a dual national, English and American, so I get to apologize for all of our wrongs.
Okay, well, yeah, I guess I'll take as much responsibility as I have to, too. I mean, that's why you're on, right? So tell us the story. Who is Shaker Amer? Well, first of all, how do I say his name right? And then please tell us all about him.
All right, you're not too far off. It's Shaker Amer. He's a British resident. He's the last British resident in Guantanamo Bay. He's been cleared for release since 2007. There's no question but that he's not guilty of anything. He's never been charged with anything. Unfortunately, he's just suffered an immense amount of abuse over the years, partly because he won't put up with their petty rules down there, so he just doesn't comply. And so he gets beaten up all the time, and that's on top of the really, really bad torture that he suffered when he was first in U.S. custody. So we just had a doctor down there, for the first time ever, an independent doctor. We got a psychiatrist in to see him for 5 days, and she's just come out with her report, which I have in front of me. It's pretty devastating. She diagnoses him with post-traumatic stress disorder for the abuse he suffered, obviously with depression. I mean, look, this chap was first sent to Guantanamo on Valentine's Day 2002, which was the day his youngest son was born. He'd never met his youngest son, who's now 12. And she also diagnoses Shaker with SHU, which is secure housing unit psychosis, because he really loses his mind down there. I've seen that when I've been to visit him. So, you know, this is a guy who's falling apart. In his own words to me, he's an old car. It's just about falling apart, and there probably isn't a garage that can put him back together now.
Okay, well, so let's go back to the beginning. If you could, please tell us, how was it that he came to be held in Guantanamo in the first place? Because, I mean, I don't know what people assume, but I'll assume that people assume the worst. That, come on, man, how did he end up in the hands of Donald Rumsfeld if he really wasn't doing anything at all?
Do you know, years ago, when Donald Rumsfeld promised that Guantanamo was full of the worst of the worst prisoners in the world, I believed him. I thought, you know, he'll make a few mistakes, as they always do, but surely when he says all of these people were captured on the battlefield of Afghanistan, you know, he can't be all wrong. Well, you know, it's just not true. I was wrong then, and Donald Rumsfeld was doubly wrong. We have so far proven, of the 779 prisoners who were held in Guantanamo, that over 90% were not fighting on any battlefield. And the way it happened, I mean, Shaq is a good example. He was in Afghanistan with a friend of his, with his family and with his friend's family, and they were working on trying to set up a school, which included girls and boys, which was a bit rare back in the day with the Taliban back then. But when the war began, everyone wanted to get out, and Shaq did too with his family. And he was one of many, many people who was turned in for a bounty. The U.S. was offering $5,000 for any, you know, bad dude in a beard who was in Afghanistan or Pakistan. And $5,000 there would translate to about $250,000 for us. So unfortunately, just a huge number of people got turned in just because people could make a lot of money out of them. That's what happened to Shaqin.
And now, it's confusing to me. I mean, I know that there's all kinds of ridiculous, you know, rules and loopholes and whatever. But I think you say in the article that aside from the fact that he's never been charged with anything, he's actually been cleared. And I know that there have been all different kind of panels. Can you tell us, does that mean that he's gotten a writ of habeas corpus and a federal judge said he could go? And then, regardless of that, can you explain why it is that they haven't let him go? Because I thought the big holdup was if you were from Yemen, then they can't let you go because the risk that you might make Obama look bad politically if for recidivism, that kind of thing. But if this guy's going home to England, then what's the problem?
Well, Scott, you're quite right. And I mean, when you say what's the problem, I have a hard time explaining that to Shaka. This is what the deal is. We didn't have to go to federal court to get a habeas relief because he was cleared by the Bush administration in 2007, and he was cleared again by the Obama administration in 2009. And when I say cleared, Obama took all six of the top U.S. Security services, you know, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and so forth, and all of them had to agree that he was no threat to anyone. And so they did. And so he's been cleared all that time. And yes, the message has been politically, oh gosh, we can't send these people back to Yemen or whatever. You know, that's just total nonsense. That's not what's going on. What's going on is that there are certain things that are really embarrassing. The reason Shaq is still there is because he's a witness in a criminal investigation in Britain against the British Security Services, MI6. And MI6 was complicit in his torture. The British police, the Metropolitan Police from London, have been to Guantanamo, have interviewed Shaka over 3 days, and he's a major witness against them. And so MI6 is desperate that he shouldn't come back to Britain. So they've been briefing against him and trying to get him shipped anywhere but Britain, because as long as he's not in London, he can't be a witness against them. Now, to try and neutralize that, finally, just a couple of weeks ago, we withdrew the criminal complaint against him just because poor old Shaq is so sick and tired of it. He'd just rather that no one was punished than that he should spend another 10 years in Guantanamo.
Well, it's just amazing. I mean, it sounds like, it's a perfectly plausible explanation for why the politics behind it. This guy would be a plaintiff. in civil court in the UK were he to come home. But if it's that obvious, then how can they get away with it? There's got to be a higher court somewhere that'll challenge the lower court, right?
Oh, look, he's already been a plaintiff in a civil court, and he's already won that case in Britain, and the British government has had to commit to paying a large amount of money in compensation. Not that Shaka cares about that. It's the criminal thing that they're really worried about, because the intelligence agents don't want to end up in prison, and that's what's been the big holdup. I hope to goodness now that they'll back off and we'll get him back to London, because he's got a wife, he's got four kids who he hasn't seen for 12 years. You know, his oldest daughter is now 16 or 17, and he hasn't seen her since she was 5.
Hmm. And it seems like, I don't know, I'm trying to think if it was a British Guantanamo prison, what the American position would be, and I guess it would be that the CIA could never be held criminally accountable in a zillion years anyway, so you might as well let him come home, right?
Well, it's true. I mean, that's certainly true. But, I mean, the flip side you have to think about is, you know, how can we possibly allow someone who's been tortured, who's suffering from serious physical and mental health problems, how can we allow him to stay one extra day in that awful place? You know, I just saw the movie The Railway Man. I don't know if it's made it to America yet. It's the Colin Firth's latest film about, you know, British guy, soldier who is held by the Japanese and tortured and all the rest of it. And, you know, he's released, obviously, at the end of the war. But, you know, what would happen if in 1945 the Japanese surrendered, but they decided they just weren't going to let the guy go for a few years? You know, the war would just carry on, wouldn't it? It was just horrifying that someone can be cleared for release and just still keep undergoing all this torture.
Well, that's a perfect analogy for this show, because I have a great uncle who was in exactly those circumstances, held by the Japanese in the Second World War, and he miraculously did survive it because they let him go at the end. If they had just held him and held him, I mean, you know, that's my own family that you're talking about actually there. So, yeah, I mean, it really is incredible. I guess you do have to put the shoe on the other foot to get people to really realize, you know, just how unfair this all is. But, you know, I mean, unless you're a Hindu anyway, you only got one shot at living. It seems pretty unfair to just lock somebody up in a dungeon without charges, you know, after the Renaissance and the Enlightenment and everything. Like, we ought to be a little bit past this in the West. I don't know. Maybe not while conquering the East.
You know, I've got to say, but for me, speaking as an American for a moment, one of the things that upsets me about this is around the world, we're just doing our own reputation no end of bad. You know, we have a reputation, or we had a reputation around the world, for standing up for human rights and being, you know, leading beacon and all of that. And I'm afraid Guantanamo Bay in particular has just caused so many problems. I travel all over. I go to Pakistan, the Middle East, and so forth. And I'm afraid people just hate us now because of this, because they think we're just hypocritical. And that's not good for us. It's not good for anyone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, even I think it's true that even when the American government is doing horrible things and the American people are backing it, usually it's under the illusion that, you know, we're fighting for Western ideals, Declaration of Independence type ideals. And then what's happened in this case, especially with the politics of the way the Abu Ghraib story broke and was covered and Fox News influence and all that back then, is that it was defended, and at least a substantial part of the population, maybe split it 50-50, decided that now actually we defend torture. And in fact, we value torture, and it's the kind of thing that it has come to define us in a way. If you believe in that whole, you know, kind of collective spirit or whatever, what makes America America anymore? It's as much torture and detention without trial as it is baseball games at this point.
Well, I hope it's not. I hope that's changing. But you can see with the latest kerfuffle in the Senate, where the CIA is, you know, trying to cover up what Senator Feinstein wants to uncover, which is this big report on CIA involvement in torture and rendition. You know, we need that stuff out in the public view. because you can't learn the lessons of the last 12 years if you don't know what's happened. And, you know, we need to make sure that we set rules in place that this never happens again. I'll tell you, this torture business hasn't done us any good. I've seen, I can't talk about a lot of it because it's classified, and I won't violate that rule, but so much of the material that you see that's been abused out of these guys is just absolute nonsense, and you can never figure out what's wheat and what's chaff once you start abusing people.
Yeah, well, that's a real important point. Well, and so let me ask you then, you have so much experience with this. Do you think that as this program was implemented, particularly, I guess, by the CIA and at Guantanamo, I know it all just kind of, you know, went haywire all over the place in Afghanistan and Iraq, but at the highest, most controlled level of the torture program, were they really trying to get the best information they could and they were just really lousy guys doing a really lousy job? Or was it really the case that they were just trying to beat the name Saddam out of all of these guys so they could find an excuse to...
There was the problem with this. You had these armchair people, people like Rumsfeld, frankly, and Wolfowitz, who had no real experience in down and dirty, who were sanctioning these abusive techniques because they honestly thought that it was going to get them information. And, you know, that just shows they haven't read any history. But they were, you know, it's far more dangerous when people are true believers than when they're corrupt. And these people were true believers and still are true believers in this whole process. And the case of Binyam Mohammed, one of my clients, is the best example of all of this. Everybody who was detained, and Binyam was detained in Pakistan, everybody who was detained in that part of the world was interrogated about nuclear weapons because everyone was paranoid that some lunatic was going to set off a nuclear bomb somewhere. And, you know, that's reasonable. It's totally understandable that people would worry about that. What's not reasonable is that they tortured people to get information. Now, when Binyam was arrested, he was from Britain, and he knew his rights. So they started interrogating him. He said he wasn't going to talk to him. So they start applying the third degree. Finally, under torture, he admits that he does indeed know how to make a nuclear bomb. And they get all excited and they really start abusing him then. And he tells them about a video he saw one time. And this is true, right? This is all corroborated now. Where he said, what you do is you take uranium, 239 and 235, you put it in a bucket and you swing it around your head for 45 minutes, and that acts as a centrifuge and divides up the uranium into the weapons-grade uranium and the other. Then when you've got it all, you mustn't have all your uranium in one bucket, but you've got your weapons-grade uranium, you've then got a nuclear bomb. Well, this was a spoof written by someone in 1975 in Florida. I tracked the woman down, and she was horrified that Binyam had been tortured to admit that he had read this article. But what's slightly more horrifying is John Ashcroft, then Attorney General of the United States, broke off his visit to Moscow to boast that they had just solved a nuclear threat when they got this out of Binyam Mohammed. They then sent Binyam to Morocco to get more information out of him, where they took a razor blade to his genitals, and all sorts of other horrible things. And, of course, it was all total, total nonsense, and yet they panicked the American people by pretending that this was something true. And what worries me is I think people like Ashcroft really believed it. Yeah. And it's far, far more dangerous that people look you in the eye and say they believe that stuff than when they're really corrupt because, you know, frankly, they were just idiotic.
Well, yeah, and, you know, in that case, that was the one where poor Binyam, they tortured him into this nuclear scare. He included Jose Padilla in on it, and this was the excuse for here was an American citizen arrested on American soil by civilian FBI police, not the military, but then was turned over to the military and the CIA to be tortured for 2 years before Bush finally indicted him. And
but
convicted
right.
him on some bogus charges that had nothing to do with a dirty bomb at all, by the way, when they finally took him to court.
No, and they wouldn't, because by then it was ludicrous. But
right.
They're just not willing to admit they made a mistake. So what they did to Jose Padilla, just like other people, is they make something else up against him.
Right.
And, you know, they're going to do them one way or the other, because the last thing these guys will do is admit that they made a whopping mistake. And that's very sad, because there's a lot of people spending time in prison just because they're victims of that sort of thing.
Right. Well, you know, I'm not sure. I'm kind of stuck on the American identity and how it gets all wrapped up in torture for some reason today, Clive. And I think what got it started was when I read about, I think you call it second degree torture in the article here. What hurt your client the most here were the threats against his family. And that was what really got me thinking about, you know, for all the slogans that people chant in defense of their government's policies, they don't really know this. They would have to close their ears and scream to not hear the truth, to not know that this is the reality of what we're talking about here, is the threats to Shocker Ahmer's children. Can you tell us about that?
Let me just read it to you. One interrogator, this is Shaka talking to his psychiatrist, and, you know, this is true. We've alleged it, and the government never even pretended to deny it. But one interrogator talked about what he'd do to my 5-year-old daughter in details that destroyed me, said Shaka. The interrogator said, they're going to screw her. She'll be screaming, Daddy, Daddy. You know, and then Shaka goes on to talk about how he was completely destroyed by this, completely disorganized. You know, it was actually the Spanish Inquisition that figured out that second-degree torture was more effective than actually torturing someone. So, you know, if I actually apply the thumb screws to you, Scott, it's painful, it's horrible, but you know it's pain and you know it's going to end. But when I start telling you what I'm going to do to your daughter or your whomever, and then I perhaps even start doing it in front of you, because Shaka was told that his daughter and his wife and his other kids had been detained as well, and they were being held along with him. He wasn't allowed to see them. And so he thought they really were going to be tortured. You know, that is exponentially worse. I have a 5-year-old myself, and the idea of someone taking my little 5-year-old child and torturing him is just beyond any possible aspect of civilization.
Well, and the thing is, I'm trying to imagine possible objections like, well, come on, it's just not believable that the American military, CIA, or anyone else would really torture somebody's 5-year-old daughter, except that the guy that they were telling that to was chained to the wall and they'd been torturing him. Think of how believable it was to him. And you think about that would make you. How angry or how whatever that would make you for someone to tell you that that's what they're going to do to your family. But now we're talking about you're locked up, chained to the wall in a gulag in communist Cuba, and the CIA's been torturing you, and they're threatening that while you are here, the definition of helpless, this is what we are going to do to your family. That is straight out of the Nazi SS. That is straight out of what Americans tell themselves they're good, because those are the kinds of people we kill, are people who do things like that to somebody else.
You know, it is worrying. I mean, I know the comparisons to the Nazis are rather inflammatory, but there is an aspect of that that's really, sad to say, rather true. You know, Shaka had lived in America. He was a big fan of America. When he was sold to the Americans for a bounty, he was actually relieved. He thought, wow, you know, thank God my trauma's over. The Americans will treat me properly. But they didn't. And, you know, it took some time to convince him that we were going to torture him. But when you think about it, we've used forms of torture that are just horrendous, and we pretend it's not torture. Take waterboarding. You know, we all now know that waterboarding was used against a number of people. The truth is not fully out about how many people yet, but a number of people. But, of course, Rumsfeld and them lied about it, and they said that this wasn't torture. They said it was enhanced interrogation techniques, as if that's somehow okay. I have a little side thing where I've been looking back historically at what different techniques that our leaders have used were called by different people. So, take waterboarding. That was called by the Spanish Inquisition tortura del agua, which obviously means water torture. When the Nazis used it, the Gestapo used it, they called it Verschaffte Vernehmung, which translates as enhanced interrogation techniques, because they too were trying to cover up the fact that they were torturing people. And it really is a sad moment in our history that Rumsfeld and them borrowed from the same lexicon as the Germans in World War II to try to pretend that what they were doing wasn't torture. And it's also sad that they really thought that this was going to achieve anything useful as opposed to just reduce us all to a terribly low level.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible. Sorry, mic was off. To finish up here, can you tell us really quick about Reprieve and how people can support you in the great work that you're doing here? So we can end on a happy note.
We're a charity, and we represent people who most need help, and I guess the people in secret prisons around the world are that. And, you know, the main office is in London, but we just actually started a U.S. branch, which is at www.reprieve.org. The British one is .org.uk. And we'd love your support, and we'd also love all the help from people who'd like to help with the work, because it's really important.
Yeah, well, I sure appreciate that the work gets done, and this is a lesson I learned real young, way before I was able to do anything. I don't know if this counts for much, but it occurred to me that if the people don't do the work just doesn't get done. We need Clive Stafford Smith. We need the CCR and the ACLU and these people who get up in the morning and do this work, or it just doesn't happen. So, you know, for God's sake, everybody, help support Reprieve so that they can sue on behalf of the helpless. That's, you know, that's the best that they can do. That's their role, and they need your support. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Great to talk to you again. That's Clive Stafford Smith, everybody, from Reprieve. Again, that's reprieve.org or reprieve.org.uk. I didn't know you could do that. .org.uk. We'll be right back in just a sec. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Man, ain't that something? I admit, I'm not the best at interviewing people, man. I screw up sometimes and stuff, but got a good choice in guests, don't I? I got a good choice in bumper music, too. I love these guys, man. I'm going to go skateboarding tonight. All right, man. So it's the show. I'm Scott Horton. Oh, man. I don't want to talk about Iraq news. I got to. Hey, listen. If you don't want to hear this, you don't have to. I'll tell you what. I'll spare you for a minute. I'll tell you something less worse first. So Brazil is marking the 50th anniversary of the fascist, military, murderous coup d'etat of mirrored sunglasses backed by the American CIA. Lyndon Johnson said, do it. And they did it. And they overthrew the government. Now, the deal is, I don't know everything about whatever brand of socialists were coming to power. They were elected. They were embarking on some kind of land reform, which may or may not have been, you know, planned to be anything like fair or what. I don't know. Land reform can mean justice finally, or it can mean national suicide, you know, depending on how you carry it out, I guess. But anyway, well, they spun it as a victory for the USSR. And that, I guess, whoever would be coming to power would then be the sock puppet satellites of the Soviet Union. Well, let's not wait and see whether that's really going to happen or not. Let's just go ahead and overthrow them, decided the Democrats, and so they overthrew them. You might not hear about that one very much, you know? A guy like me, a guy like Hornberger, we like to say things like, you know, overthrow Iran, overthrow Guatemala, skip a few, Vietnam, Chile, Grenada. But man, there's a whole bunch in there. There's so many. In fact, we're going to be running one at antiwar.com tomorrow. Remember that guy Nicholas J.S. Davies that I had on the show, and he talked all about all the coups and whatever? He's got another great one. It's at alternet.org. America's coup machine, destroying democracies since 1953. And he's quoting William Blum, and I'm not sure who else. Is it Blum or Bloom? Former State Department guy. And he's counting dozens and dozens of coups. And he explains how they do it, you know, with all the step-by-step process and whatever. Nothing new under the sun. The American regime change, coup machine, destroying democracy since 53. Iraq-style invasions, those are the outliers. That's only when the coup fails. Anyway, there's so many of these. But if you're Brazilian, it might matter to you, you know, if it was your family that got murdered in order to consolidate the gains of the coup leaders, whatever it was. But here's why you might should internalize Karen at all, even if you ain't Brazilian and you just don't know any Brazilians. I got one for you. I know a guy. You see him on TV sometimes. I'm not going to tell you who he is because this might, you know, make him look bad in front of somebody that is stupid. So I wouldn't want that to happen. But there's a guy who I used to know who was in Brazil on September 11th. And I forget now if he was in Rio or in Sao Paulo, but I don't suppose it makes much of a difference, does it? And what happened was when the towers were burning and falling, the people were gathered around the store windows watching the TVs like, you know, back in the 50s or the 60s. Or I don't know, I used to see on TV that that used to be a thing. People would gather on the sidewalk in front of the electronics store and watch the breaking news. Kennedy announces a quarantine of Cuba, that kind of thing, right? Well, it was a scene just like that, as everybody gathered around on the sidewalk to watch the attack on New York and Washington through the store window. And according to this guy that I used to know, who had no reason to lie, and he was really sad about it at the time, actually, or, I don't know, matter of fact about it anyway, when he told me. They weren't cheering. But they were kind of looking at each other and nodding. And they would do that kind of thing where they make a fist, they don't hold it up in the air like, rah, but they kind of make a fist and clench it close to their chest and kind of do a slight little fist pump of a little bit of a tiny bit of a celebration. And the thing is about it is that the Brazilians ain't bad. I'm not trying to start a war against Brazil by creating the slightest hard feelings and driving some right-winger mad. But I'm just telling you, you know, by that time, it had been 40 years, almost, since the coup there. And they weren't over it. They didn't forgive us. Or if they did, still, show them America feeling what it's like just once. And they can't help but kind of nod and approve. And think about what that means. You know? Found this out the hard way when I was a kid, I'll admit. The reason everybody hates you, Scott, is because you're acting like a jerk all the time. Oh, are you sure that that's what it is? Yes, dude, it's you. Okay, fine. I guess maybe it's me. It's you, America. The Brazilians don't hate you because of Brazilians. They hate you because of you. They hate you because of what your grandpa did, or at least, you know, sat back and encouraged the Democrats to do, or whatever the hell, however you phrase it. people do hold each other collectively responsible in nation states. I'm not saying it's fair. I'm just saying. That's what Osama was doing that day, and that's what the Brazilians were doing that day with their kind of little silly half celebration on the sidewalk, watching those towers burn, watching people jump to their deaths, watching them be crushed to oblivion. They were kind of silently nodding and making approving eye contact with each other and maybe even whispering, "Now you know what it feels like." And of course, the Americans completely got the wrong lesson that day, which was, oh my God, here we were completely minding our own business, watching Seinfeld reruns and doing nothing. And then all of a sudden, the Martians attacked us. And so, of course, you know, we have to wage a holy jihad to defend ourselves from their aggression. In the name of God and country and democracy and freedom and all that stuff. No idea. And of course, then, who did they say was celebrating? They didn't say, hey, America, you want to know what people think of you? Look at the way the Brazilians were kind of, sort of, little bit celebrating what happened to you yesterday. Instead, we were shown fake pictures of Palestinians celebrating. It was just some birthday party. Oh, look, some old woman dancing and jumping up and down and saying something in Arabic I can't understand. It sounds something like happy birthday to you, but I'm not sure. I'm not 100% positive. Did she just say, let's go ahead and light the candles now and then we can do presents? Is that what she said? Anyway, yeah, here, we have some footage ready of a celebrating Palestinian. Believe that they're talking about you. And of course, you know, none of this is to justify what happened, of course. I hope you don't need to be told that. It's stupid that I should even have to stop for a minute. But a reason and an excuse ain't the same thing. Nobody's got the right to kill innocent civilians for whatever. That's it. Full stop. That's over. End of argument. Nobody has the right to do that, ever. Osama doesn't have the right to kill innocent people like a Democrat or a Republican would. How dare he be as murderous as them? Belongs with, you know, shark bait. I'm not saying that. And I'm not saying that, you know, any Brazilian would be justified in thinking that any individual who died that day deserved to die that day, other than the hijackers. But I mean, you know, the victims. And I don't think that they did, right? I bet if you had asked, a follow-up question of any of those people, they would have said, no, I mean, it's horrible, man. Imagine the poor people on the planes who were torn to smithereens and the giant building falling on people's heads, and it's a catastrophe. It's an absolute catastrophe. But there was, to them, there was a silver lining. That's the point. To them, in the midst of horror, and the whole world, you know, the whole world was like, oh my God, that's horrible. We feel bad for y'all. Immediately, that was the reaction all over the world. That was the reaction in Brazil, too. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it was laced with a bit of these things happen kind of attitude. You understand? And so, all I'm saying is there's a lesson there. And the lesson is that 9/11 is really Bill Clinton's fault as much as it's Osama's fault or George Bush's fault. Bill Clinton provoked it. George Bush failed to stop it. And Osama and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the rest of the conspirators, they did it, the sons of bitches. I ain't saying that. But the point is that Bill Clinton murdered Iraqis from bases in Saudi Arabia nonstop for 8 years, and that's the cause of the attacks. And really, before that, George Bush Sr. and Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter and the rest of them, Ford and Nixon too, supported Israel's occupations of the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And as well as, since Reagan, the permanent, at least at that time, permanent occupation of southern Lebanon too, and war against the Lebanese that whole time. So that was what caused it. I mean, and, you know, that was what the guys that did it said. Here are the causes. And anyway, so just so you know, it made the post. And you know what? Damn it, I got one more thing to say about this, everybody. Guess what? In the Washington Post, it's not until the last paragraph. I'm amazed they even bring this up at all. The headline, it probably didn't even make the paper, just the website. I don't know. The headline is, as Brazil marks 50th anniversary of the coup, more people open up about the dictatorship. Yeah, before they were scared, they'd just be murdered. So they kept their mouths shut. It was already a done deal. But anyway, here is the only mention of American involvement is at the very end. Meanwhile, Brown University and the State University of Maringá in Brazil have begun releasing thousands of State Department and declassified CIA documents that show the extent of U.S. logistical and political support for the coup. On a recent day, Alina Assis, 29, a student in Rio, purchased a magazine with a cover story about the U.S. involvement. It is not a surprise that the USA supported it, she said, but it is a surprise that it's in a Brazilian magazine, even after all this time. And that's the most the Post will tell you about it, as somebody in Brazil's covering it. Go there. Ask Greenwald. He'll tell you. He'll translate it from Portuguese for you. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. So, you know what? I don't want to go on a whole rant about the war in Iraq and everything else. Let me just tell you that the regime America has installed in power there is now going to legalize the marriage of children. And I don't mean like in Texas where 14 is all right with parental consent. I mean kids. It's in the Telegraph. And I actually really like the headline, which says, if this law goes through, we need to look at ourselves in the mirror here and ask ourselves what we've done here in Iraq. Really? There's a million dead people. Millions of refugees, internally displaced about 2.5 million, externally displaced about 2.5 million. And now I guess millions of those have come home, at least from Syria. I guess most of the ones in Jordan are still there. Jesus. And you know, the Telegraph is really rubbing it in here too, because it's a picture of a little girl, probably 4 or 5 years old, walking with her mother. And anyway, in the Islamic Republic of Iraq, under the rule of the Shiite parties, the Dawah Party, and the Sadrists, they have introduced what's known as the Jafari Law. Don't tell me named after the former Prime Minister, Jafari. And what it says is, here in the Telegraph, anyway, that Iyad Alawi is warning. Remember him? That, quote, it allows for girls to be married from 9 years of age and even younger, he said. While there's no set minimum age for marriage, the section on divorce includes rules for divorces of girls who have reached the age of 9. Marital rape is condoned by a clause that says that states women must comply with their husband's sexual demands. Men are given guardianship rights over women, and the law also establishes rules governing polygamous relationships. Wait, did they edit this and change it? Because where's the part where it says the automatic custody of children in case of divorce and the children being over the age of 2? Wasn't that in here? Where's that? I think they edited this article. Or maybe, oh, you know what? That might have come from the follow-up article, which was, this was the follow-up, was the opinion piece. If Iraq legalizes childhood marriage, it's time for us to look in the mirror. I bet that's where that other detail comes from. It was in here. Anyway, that's in the Telegraph over there in the UK. That the Iraqi parliament... Hey, majority rules! They're so much better off now than under Saddam Hussein. Can't cut and run now. The violence will get worse. Oh, the surge is working. The surge is working. The surge has worked. The surge has worked. Cut and run. The surge is working. And meanwhile, that's the real result of all these slogans shouted where the rubber meets the road. That's what democracy means in Iraq. Oh, and it also means thousands and thousands of new Al-Qaeda guys in a lawless, completely lawless territory between Baghdad and the sea, basically. Anyway, well, there you go. Okay, now let's talk about this. There's this great article. I'm all over the place topic-wise, but I don't care. It's my show. I can be if I want to be. If I can find the damn thing. The truth about Chicago's crime rates. Remember I talked about confirmation bias? And when two studies come out and one that says more guns, less crime, and the other just says more guns, more crime, liberals and conservatives still only believe whatever the hell they want and they don't care about, you know, what the truth is. And I don't just mean changing their policy preferences, but I mean even in accepting what facts are actually facts or not. Well, and then this was one of the examples, right? Was crime rate in Chicago plummets after gun ownership, the carrying of guns outside of your own house, is finally legalized in Chicago, which had formerly the strictest gun control in America. Turns out, there's a more immediate and plausible explanation, which is that the cops are lying and they're letting people get away with murder so that they don't have to classify murders as murders so that their numbers can be better. Anybody who has seen the show The Wire, you can listen to music for the next couple of minutes. Anybody else, go watch the show The Wire and they'll explain exactly how this works. Some bureaucrats need to pretend the numbers are different. So then the other bureaucrats start lying about what the numbers are. And the people can all be damned. Come on. Did you think that the purpose of the government of Chicago was protecting the people of Chicago? Do you think that that's ever what their job actually was? It's ridiculous. You read about this thing. This is somebody's kids. Somebody's daughter, somebody's sister, somebody's mother murdered. And the cops say, oh, geez, I don't know, man. Looks like it could have been an accident to me. And then they don't even try to find who did the murder. Because then they'd have to admit it's a murder, and that makes their numbers look bad. Just the same way that if they brought in an innocent person and beat it out of them that, yeah, sure, I'll sign anything you want if you'll stop torturing me, please. And they hand that person over to the prosecutor. The prosecutor's perfectly happy to put an innocent person in prison for decades. Not my job to determine whether they really did it or not. It's just my job to bring a case if I think I can bring a case. It's the jury's job to decide whether he really did it or not. They'll rationalize anything. Hell, probably most of the time they don't even rationalize. I don't care. Especially after that 10,000th time they prosecuted some innocent person for no good reason. They don't care. So at the same time you're reading about the city of Chicago letting innocent people go free so they can keep their numbers down, you can read about how the cops everywhere else are convicting innocent people. And the prosecutors are convicting innocent people to keep their numbers up. And then this one, man. You know what? Here's your war on drugs. Those of you who really mean well and you just can't imagine a situation living in a society where drugs, I mean drugs, are legal. It's just crazy, you think. You just can't wrap your brain around it. Well, here. Wrongful death lawsuit filed against Huntsville police. A Madison County woman is suing the city of Huntsville, the police chief, and five police officers in the death of her 17-year-old son. Nancy Smith says her son died after police used excessive force during an undercover drug bust. Smith's lawsuit states the excessive force happened at her Madison County home on June 13th last year. She claims officers sent in an undercover teenager to sell drugs to her 17-year-old son. And officers were hiding nearby to make any arrests. Smith claims that after he allegedly purchased the drugs, one of the officers threw him to the ground, handcuffed him, and pepper sprayed him. She then claims he began choking uncontrollably while an officer shoved a knee into his back. Documents from the lawsuit state that officers called paramedics when he became motionless on the ground. When they arrived, officers told paramedics he was choking because he swallowed a bag of drugs. Court documents also state an officer shoved a sharp object down his throat to retrieve the bag of drugs, which was never found. Smith claims paramedics were on the scene for approximately 22 minutes trying to resuscitate her son before taking him to the emergency room. He died in the hospital 5 days later. Smith is suing for wrongful death, excessive force, unlawful search and seizure, and more. She's asking police to change a list of procedures, including the use of informants and getting proper training for medically compromised suspects. Smith is asking for compensatory and punitive damages. Huntsville police told us Tuesday night, quote, "Our department will not be making any statement concerning that case." And so there you go. They didn't entrap him into selling drugs. They entrapped him into buying some. And then they murdered him. A 17-year-old boy. And when they say drugs, that means pot. Because if it meant cocaine, they would say cocaine. Fox 54. And even if it was cocaine or heroin, still, they killed a 17-year-old boy, entrapped him into being a customer. And then they killed him. And it's just like the footage that came out from the mall where the woman and the daughter got in a screaming match and the mom slapped the daughter. And then the cops came and murdered the father. Four or five cops, they pinned him, handcuffed him behind his back, and then there they all are with their knees on him, including the one cop who's looking right at the wife who's filming them and screaming hysterically, you know, is he okay and all of this. And the cop's got his knee right in the back of the guy's neck. And in fact, I'm not certain, but they said in the comments that if you play it real loud, you can hear his last words are, "I can't breathe." They just suffocated him to death right there. And then it's horrible. I mean, they sit there. You can look at the footage online. You can find it easy enough. They sit there and play Weekend at Bernie's and prop up his corpse against the cop's knee. After he's dead, he's clearly dead. And the cops are whispering to each other, "Ah, Christ, we killed him. Oops." And then they're propping him up and lying to the wife and telling her that, "Oh, no, he's okay. He's going to be all right." This is our security force. These are our heroes.